Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's yet to be cancelled on Twitter. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello.
Now, it's a week before we leave the European Union, and one of the things that we've talked about a little bit as the Brexit farrago has gone on is the culture war aspect of the Brexit debate, and obviously cultural issues like attitudes to hanging, attitudes to women's rights, say, were factoring how people, also seemed to influence how people saw the referendum result. And so what we're going to have a look at is see how that culture war is manifesting itself as we go into the 2020s and go into the post-Brexit fantasy life that awaits us. Steve, let's talk about bongs.
Oh, wonderful.
In case you're not aware, listeners, it's the interminable discussion about whether or not Big Ben is going to...
Bong for breakfast. Brexit.
Not bong for breakfast. You're thinking Downton Abbey.
Yeah, a little, I am. Yeah. Which is it sounds about right for the Tory government.
Has the UK tabloid press lost its mind?
There's plenty of evidence to support that across many different topics, so I'm going to just go with the safe bet of yes. Yes, it has. But especially on this, I feel. This is such an odd thing to try and kind of like die on a hill for. Whether or not Big Ben bongs on the day of Brexit is kind of ridiculous. I kind of think that this has become a talking point for the government just because Boris Johnson enjoys alliteration. And he can constantly go on about Big Ben bonging for Brexit.
I feel there must be some sort of Freudian explanation about why they're so obsessed about this big tower and its lack of working.
I mean, you might think that, but I could not possibly comment.
Genuine front pages, though, on the Daily Express and the Daily Telegraph, which one remembers used to be a...
Serious newspapers.
Yeah. It's still a broadsheet, despite, you know, everything. I suppose it's this idea that somehow leaving will be so...
momentous
and totemic, but then nothing will change until the end of December anyway. That's when we leave the no deal Brexit after we completely flunked the negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, so much of the Brexit ideology, for lack of a better term for it, seems to be versed in symbology in one form or another. If it's not a Big Ben bonging for Brexit, it's the colour of our passports, bringing back the black or dark blue, whatever colour it was.
Blue passports? Black passports?
I don't know.
Who has black passports?
I've no idea. I don't care what colour my passport is.
I'm a member of Hades and here I am with my black passport.
Yeah. You know, there's so much of this seems to just be about symbolic representations of Britain being strong, Britain being having influence rather than having actual meaningful influence. So rather than actually, you know, sitting at the table helping shape, you know, the decisions that affect the world as part of the EU, we get to have a 5 minute celebration, quote unquote, for leaving with Big Ben like letting out some bongs.
So that makes it sound like a DJ. I think maybe a wider point is, and I suppose it's this idea of culture, it's this idea of two tribes that don't necessarily understand the other, which it can get overplayed. But I think one of the things that it would be nice to try and talk about is Boris Johnson and his government are trying to make the point that they would like to bring the country together. So this was part of Johnson's leadership pitch in the first place.
Yeah.
How do you unite the country with Leavers and Remainers, all this kind of stuff? What I'm not sure about, I mean, if you're going to, the thing with celebrating Britain leaving the European Union is, you've surely got to recognise that lots of people are very saddened by it. We are all going to lose our citizenship rights. We have EU citizens here, 900,000 of whom apparently haven't applied for settled status, whose rights are very uncertain still and in absolute limbo. We've got a new cliff edge at the end of 2020, and lots of people are still very anxious about that. And it isn't just FBPE Twitter. It's hard, I think, for the government to try and bring the country together when they haven't quite realised this isn't quite a celebration. Like, you don't turn up to your grandma's funeral with a coloured suit on and some fireworks.
The thing about culture wars is that there's very little middle ground. You're either for something or you're against it. And as a result, it automatically end up kind of like at loggerheads with the opposition in one form or another. So Brexit as a whole has kind of turned into that. But even little elements around it just become kind of like, as you say, symbolic of that kind of that clash of the two different sides here. As you say, the actual meaningful impact of Big Ben being fixed in time so that it can actually, you know, ring out as Brexit occurs is zero. Like, it doesn't actually matter in any meaningful way at all. But it feels like because people have said, no, that can't be done, and Big Ben is such an emblematic part of Britain, you know, the Brexiteers have kind of jumped on it and saying, ah, no, it must happen, because they're saying it can't.
Which in many ways is a useful metaphor for Brexit.
Yeah.
We saw an interesting bit of populism, though, from Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Which is obviously something unusual for him, in which he talks about maybe there being some sort of crowdfunding operation, because the cost of this will be £500,000. And the government, for some reason, didn't want to just spend £500,000 on some vague gesture. So Johnson said instead maybe we could launch some sort of crowdfunding operation.
It seems to have become the new way of trying to get something discussed, but without actually committing to doing anything meaningful about it. People have donated like $230,000 or something, I think.
They have at the time of recording. Yeah. They might even have reached the hallowed $500,000 by the time this podcast comes out.
Even if it reaches that $500,000 mark, it's still basically going to be probably not enough time to actually get the work done anyway. So crowdfunding seems to be the new Royal Commission. You know, we're going to try and get people talking about this topic by saying we're going to fundraise for it. Get some true believers to donate some money, which will get pocketed by a campaign somewhere, and then not do anything about it, because that's not what the point of this is.
Just because you can raise the money for something doesn't mean that you can do that thing, or should do that thing.
Yep.
It's not really how capitalism works. I suppose the other bit of populism that we're seeing in terms of the culture war at the moment is the terms of the Brexit Bill itself. Now, they are still passing through the House of Lords at the moment.
Yep.
So at the time of recording, these clauses aren't in the House of Lords Bill. I think they're trying to get them in the Lords.
Yeah.
These are the provisions for child refugees.
This was actually something that was supported by Theresa May's government previously. The policy is that if you are an unaccompanied child refugee and you already have family who are in the UK, you can come over to the UK. Basically saying, hey, there are kids over here who should really be with family members, and those family members are over here, therefore let's bring them over. It's pretty standard. It shouldn't be that controversial, and yet the government is voting against it.
Yes, as you say, originally it was part of the Theresa May deal, now it isn't part of the Boris Johnson deal. The subplot here is the Labour MPs who kept voting against Theresa May's deal, even with extra provisions in, and then as soon as that deal was no longer on the table, started wringing their hands and voting for Boris Johnson's deal, which was worse. That's a separate discussion, though. And it's put forward by Alf Dubs,
yep,
who I believe was a member of the Kinder Transport himself. I think he himself is a refugee, former Labour MP as well. There's been big cultural discussions over immigration for decades, centuries in Britain. And reminds me of an interesting talking politics. So we mentioned a couple of times on the podcast, the Cambridge University show. And they did a really interesting series on different aspects of American history, how that might play out in the 2020 race. One of which was about the deportations of Mexicans, which happened in the 1930s. And Gary Gerstle's the academic as part of that. And the argument that he was making is that these sort of debates over refugees, who is and is not allowed to come in, is going to come into a country, is going to be even more a heightened issue in the years ahead because of the climate crisis. I mean, we've seen floods in Indonesia just recently, and we're going to see more and more refugees coming to more developed countries essentially as their home countries become unlivable.
And what you'll probably also end up seeing is a kind of like a dual standard coming into effect, where if you're from Indonesia, if you're from a sub-Saharan African country, say, which is kind of having problems due to climate change, you know, you'll be a refugee and it will be problematic. Whilst you will almost certainly, I suspect, see a number of people moving away from Australia because, hey, the entire country's on fire at the moment, seemingly.
Well, the day of recording, actually, there was thunderstorms and therefore risk of floods.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, the country's been on fire quite recently. As climate change continues to be an issue, things are going to continue, if not get worse, in terms of those sorts of stuff. But you can guarantee that people who end up leaving Australia will be treated very, very differently.
Well, Australia's an interesting point, an interesting case in point, because one of the culture sub-wars, a kind of a skirmish in the culture war, is the talk of trying to abolish the Department for International Development and wrap it in with a Foreign Office rather than have it as a department on its own. And one of the ways in which it's been attacked recently is by people saying that we can't use the DFID budget to help Australia in terms of the international development budget because Australia doesn't qualify. Obviously, it doesn't qualify because Australia is quite a rich country,
yeah,
as opposed to, say, sub-Saharan Africa or Indonesia. I suppose the other thing about Australia at the moment is, I mean, Scott Morrison's government won on a very anti-green agenda,
yeah,
manifesto, and so it's part of that politics playing out right at the moment. And in fact, in terms of immigration to Australia, apparently Australia's rejected overtures from the UK government for some sort of post-Brexit trade deal on the grounds of not wanting to give the UK lots of immigration and visas.
Yeah.
They were worried about unskilled Brits going to Australia. It turns out Australia prefer an Australian-style point system, as I saw one commentator suggest. But the wider point about then refugees and the climate crisis is, and the point that Gary Gerster was making on Talking Politics is, the right has a very clear response to the issue of climate refugees and refugees in particular. They're going to build up walls. I mean, we've seen what the Trump administration does. It's morally indefensible. It's not quite so clear where the left is on this culture war at the moment.
You basically have a split in terms of how the left wants to kind of approach the issue. You've got the ones who basically go, no, we shall take what we consider to be the morally defensible stance. We shall argue in favour of letting refugees in. We shall argue in favour of freedom of movement and all of those sorts of things. But you also have, at the same time, individuals who are viewing themselves as pragmatists, I think is how they would kind of term it, and saying, well, we need to, you know, actually pay attention to the views and concerns of people who are not necessarily as in favour of these things as we are, and then kind of move our policy towards them, i.e. be a bit harsher towards immigrants. You know, maybe we don't let in quite so many refugees. Something which I would say is kind of indicative of a lot of Blue Labour kind of thinking.
Hashtag towns.
Hashtag towns. But interestingly, now we've said hashtag towns, that's not necessarily indicative of Lisa Nandy's thinking, given she's gone out of her way to, like, defend freedom of movement and things like that as part of her leadership campaign. So,
although, as we suggested on last week's podcast, part of that is having a cake-and-eat-it approach.
Yeah.
In the same way you can make a pitch for internationalism and still vote for a Brexit deal, which is the opposite of internationalism.
Yeah.
I mean, the point on the left in refugees is you've still got what ends up, essentially, I suppose, being the Ed Miliband position on immigration, which is essentially, well, Steve, you say that you care about immigration, but actually you're not really interested in immigration. What you really care about is jobs, or wages, or working conditions, or access to housing, or access to public services. And therefore, you need a migration impact fund.
The issue with that, from my perspective, is that if you look at America, for instance, it's not that people are actually concerned about the impact of migration. They just don't like the fact that these people are here now, or coming over here. There are almost certainly people who are concerned about all of those things, and because they're being told that a load of these problems are coming from immigrants, they are blaming immigrants for that. But equally, I think there is just as much actual racism that's driving a lot of this sort of stuff as well. And I think as a movement. The left needs to actually kind of come to grips with that and realise that actually we need to combat that. And that actually probably does mean going for full-throated defences of things and not just kind of going, migrant impact funds, that's a great policy.
I suppose Nandi's point in her defence of free movement was about how to champion it.
Yeah.
Moving slightly on, another aspect of the culture war plays out, usually it's played out much more in America than it has in the UK. Interestingly here, it's played out on the UK left. And that's the culture war around abortion. We didn't mention it in our Labour leadership podcast because we had important discussions to talk about, like what cheese Keir Starmer is.
Yep, you know, very important things.
It's cheddar, and it still is cheddar, in case you were wondering. We missed out the kerfuffle, one might say, about Rebecca Long Bailey and her stance on abortion.
Yeah, so I think this was last year she got asked a question about this or something. It was a while back, I think. And she got asked about abortion. I'm not even sure what the exact question was. But what she essentially said was that she thought that there you needed to have an equitable... Well, basically, need to treat fetuses that are disabled the same as any other type of fetus, which caused furore, because that would effectively mean... changing the law so that it limited women's reproductive rights in a way, and yeah, there ended up being quite a bit of kickback against Rebecca Long Bailey on this front, with all kinds of interesting kind of like comments being made about Catholicism thrown into the mix as well.
Fantastic, isn't it? Yeah, all of the anti-Catholic stuff. So Paul Mason said, we don't want Labour's policy dictated by the Vatican, which was, any fans of American politics may remember the attacks on JFK in 1960, and exactly the same things were being said 60 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if you take like Paul Mason's tweet and replace his statements about the Vatican controlling the policy with, say, imams or the board of deputies, you end up in a very kind of much more troubling kind of message, or that a message that most people would view as much more troubling and troublesome. There seems to have been quite that anti-Catholic backlash occurring, simply because it's an acceptable form of discrimination.
I feel like I like to have thought that the Labour Party would have had enough with dual loyalty tropes. We've had a lot of it about Israel and Judaism, as you've hinted. And it would be really nice if we didn't have an anti-Catholic aspect to it as well. And as you say, it's almost... One almost sounds like Roger Scruton to say it, but God rest him. But it wouldn't be acceptable with any other faith.
No.
And it's almost acceptable to kick because it's Catholicism.
Yeah.
There was enough to attack Rebecca Long Bailey on anyway. And I find it particularly distasteful... Friends of mine on the Labour right who will quite happily excuse some of their colleagues on the Labour right for their views on gay rights, for instance, who have gone out of their way to attack Rebecca Long Bailey on this, and I find it particularly distasteful.
Yeah, but again, what is quite fascinating about this is that there hasn't really been so much of a kind of like the right kind of pushing for this kind of conversation happening in the UK. So much about the US culture war around abortion is because there's an awful lot of Republicans and right-wingers enacting legislation, trying to get legislation through, which seriously limits women's reproductive rights. In the UK, you get the occasional politician like Jeremy Hunt who basically says, my personal opinion is X, but I don't want to change the law. That's about the full brunt of what you get. So you do end up seeing like less of a kind of like a war between the left and the right in the way that you get you would expect with a lot of cultural war stuff. But instead what you get is an internal kind of conflict in the left, because I think almost like the left has almost been programmed to expect this kind of conversation from what happens in the US. And because we don't want to get to that position where the limitation of women's reproductive rights is normalised, we jump on any instance very, very hard and very, very quickly.
So one of the Talking Politics episodes I mentioned before in that series was on the shifting position of evangelical Christians towards abortion, and it has done it's done a complete switch in the past 40 years. And so it used to be that the Democratic Party was full of politicians like JFK who were Catholics, not terribly down with abortion. Jimmy Carter, Baptist minister, another example. And the Republicans were reversed, and actually the Republicans were more in favour of abortion, and it was seen as a bit like a moral issue. So things like prohibition and abortion would be kind of put together as moral issues, and the Republicans would be in favour of it. And that, and the complete switcheroo happens in the 70s with essentially the rise of an evangelical Christian right, and Ronald Reagan being a politically flexible and morally flexible enough politician to want to hammer home that evangelical right and get that constituency. And I suppose one of the reasons it hasn't really played out like that in this country is because the UK just hasn't got that huge nature of a massive evangelical right. And most of the friends I know, my friends who are evangelical Christians, they're on the left and don't really proselytise about abortion in the same way. And certainly in terms of the Tory party, the Church of England's the Tory party at prayer. It's not really seen as a massive issue there. Same with Labour. I mean, the moral issue was temperance, really. It's never really been abortion as such. It's a very different climate, I think.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. Although I do think it is quite interesting that what you said there about actually an awful lot of the event, there is a good chunk of evangelicals in the UK who are off the left, or at least left-leaning in some form. I mean, just look at Parliament where Tim Farron still holds a seat, just about.
People like Stephen Timms as well. Yeah. And I think, I mean, there are equivalents of people in the US. So Jim Wallis is one who written book books like God's Politics, which is about trying to reclaim that kind of evangelical Christianity from the Republican right and talk about that kind of social justice aspect. It's certainly in the US, it's not necessarily been much of an issue, and still are. I mean, evangelicals quite happy to vote for Donald Trump, which is an interesting,
because, and to quote an article I read the other day, they forgive him.
Well, that's jolly lovely then.
It really is.
I'm sure all you listeners are as pleased as I am that we've got two more months of Labour leadership race, and already we've gone to abortion. So heaven knows what we're going to talk about in Hustings for the next 6 weeks. We're going to talk, final thing then, so Harry and Meghan. Mary? Hagen? Not really sure the portmanteau there. We're going to talk about that the issue mainly in terms of the issue of race on another podcast in the next couple of months. You might have seen, as we have listeners, the BuzzFeed article comparing newspaper headlines about Kate Middleton and newspaper articles about Meghan Markle when they are doing the exact same thing.
And yet the headlines are so very, very different.
Is what's happening with Harry and Meghan at the moment, is that part of the culture war, do you think?
I don't necessarily think it is. Don't get me wrong, I think there's a lot of insidious racism around the coverage that Meghan Markle has received. I wrote a small piece on the Not Enough Champagne website, kind of talking about kind of the royal family's response to kind of like Harry and Meghan and wanting to leave. And I mentioned in there that racism was clear, but that would be happening anyway, I feel, without this culture war context. I suspect if there is a culture war element to this, it's just going to be the more broad thing where the right is more likely to be, you know, more likely to be monarchists. The left is more likely to be Republican, and even if not outright kind of calling for the abolition of the monarchy, they're going to care less about the royal family overall, and therefore they'll just be like, no, let them get on with it.
It's playing out more in terms of their people's attitude to personal liberty, I suppose.
Yeah.
Culture only in the sense that the sort of the strange way in which a lot of the press talk about the royals anyway. Even the BBC, there's a sort of strange hushed hysteria, which I'm guessing, I think part of it is whenever there's a royal function, royal correspondents just have to find anything to fill up airwaves, and so we'll find anything to talk about, however inane.
Yeah, absolutely. To the extent where, based on what both Kate Middleton and Prince William and Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have said, they just make stuff up. Like, they just outright lie about what's been going on because they're desperate to fill inches.
That's it. If you have any suggestions of other topics we could talk about as part of future Culture War podcasts, please do let us know. My Twitter handle is @paperbackrioter.
Mine's @acousticradical.
We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Twitter handle's @nochampagnepod. Or we have a Facebook page at facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. We also have a Patreon page, don't we, Steve?
We do, yes. You can go to patreon.com/notenoughchampagne, where you can sign up to support the podcast. If you do, you'll get access to all kinds of lovely content. Podcasts coming out early, blogs, some exclusive content in terms of like recordings and things that we do, as well as some other bits and bobs that will be going up.
And a shout out to one of our Patreon subscribers. It's called Phil Wallace.
Yeah.
Who apparently signed up.
Yeah, I don't think it's the Phil Wallace.
I had no idea he was a fan.
Maybe he just hates himself and just likes hearing you swear about him all the time.
Maybe.
I mean, to be fair, Phil Wallace hating himself, it would be fair enough.
I really hate Phil Wallace. And even though I'm kind of staring at his name on the show notes, and now I've said his name, I do feel quite angry with myself.
And on that note, listeners,
happy plotting.